Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host. Coming up on the program, Malawi holds its first ever televised presidential debate ahead of elections next month, with the main contenders, including President Joyce Banda, absent.
This shows the lack of seriousness on the part of the incumbent president.
The head of state failing to turn up. It shows lack of commitment to coming out clear on what she intended to do.
Also on the program, we will hear from a new generation in South Africa for whom apartheid is just a part of history.
If a black girl starts dating a white guy, she feels like she's made it in life, kind of thing. And I'm like, why? You just have more melanin in your skin than he does, kind of thing. So why is it such a big deal?
These stories and more to come on the program straight from the studios of Deutsche Welle here in Bonn, Germany. So stay tuned.
Top story.
With less than a month to go before Malawi holds tripartite elections, that's presidential, parliamentary and local elections, 8 of the 12 presidential candidates on Tuesday night outlined their plans for a better Malawi in a televised debate. They used the opportunity to explain to the electorate where they stand on key issues affecting the country, like the rampant corruption in the public service and how they intend to improve the country's education sector. Surprisingly, the main contenders, that is incumbent President Joyce Banda of the Governing People's Party and her rival Peter Mutharika of the former ruling Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, boycotted the debate, much to the disappointment of Malawians. George Muhango reports.
Perhaps those candidates who did take part in the debate are not feeling too sad at the absence of Joyce Banda and Peter Mutharika, as this gave them more time to explain where their parties stand on issues such as corruption and the need for more equality education in Malawi. 8 parties were represented in the debate, and many of the speakers impressed the general public.
I think Chakwera of Malawi Congress Party was so articulate in issues to do with farming. Likewise, at Tupere Muruzi on education and agriculture.
To me, there's Mr. Mike Katsonga. With his 20-point plan, at least you could see some fresh ideas, something we haven't heard before.
The debate gave the candidates time to explain how they would revamp the economy through agriculture, bearing in mind the controversial issue of a fertilizer subsidy program, which some economists say drains taxpayers' money. Atupele Muluzi of the United Democratic Front, who is regarded as one of the front runners, highlighted the importance of the elections.
Malawians are worried about the future, and this is perhaps one of the most important elections for generations. We are celebrating 50 years of our independence, 20 years of democratic rule, and I believe the solution lies in quality leadership.
Helen Singh of the United Independence Party criticized the present government for not doing enough for the development of Malawi.
The poverty levels in Malawi are very deep and very painful. But this nation is very rich. And the rich resources of this nation are not used for the development and the bringing up the level of life in this country.
President Joyce Banda claimed a clash of appointments and a tight campaign schedule were the reasons why she could not take part. As her People's Party Secretary General Paul Maulidi explained, I quote, "We received the invitation, but we have expressed regrets to the organizers that she cannot afford to attend those debates. This is campaign period and she's busy reaching out to people." There was no word from DPP candidate Peter Mutharika regarding his absence. For the record, also missing from the debate were Davis Katsonga of Chipani Chafuko CCP and George Nessa, leader of the Tisinta Alliance, due to flight problems. Many Blanta residents are not happy that Banda and Mutharika failed to show up.
This shows the lack of seriousness on the part of the incumbent president and anyone who failed to make it. These 4 candidates were supposed to avail their policies to the nation. To say she's busy or that they are busy with campaign is not on, because how did others make it to the venue?
I think as the head of state failing to turn up for the first ever debate, not for just this election but in the history of politics in Malawi, it shows lack of commitment to coming out clear on what she intended to do.
George Muhango compiled that report. Before we came on air, I spoke to Augustine Magolwondo, Africa Regional Program Coordinator at the Netherlands Institute for Multi-Party Democracy, based in Lilongwe, Malawi. I asked him whether he thought the absence of the main contenders at the presidential debate would hurt their chances in the elections.
Well, we do not have opinion polls that are conducted in the country in the run-up towards the elections, but the public mood is such that we expected these two parties also to take part in this particular debate. And it therefore came as a disappointment to quite a majority of the electorate, particularly their supporters, these two parties not showing up. I think it has left quite a number of people speculating and guessing as to why the two parties did not turn up. And I think this would have somewhat a negative impact on their prospects.
Indeed, we've just heard from our correspondent in Blantyre that many ordinary Malawians are disappointed, just like you mentioned, that the main contenders didn't take part in the TV discussion. Are the candidates aware of the importance of these debates?
I don't think they are aware. In so far as I understand, the organizers of the presidential debates did carry out consultations. And I'm also aware of the focus group survey that the National Democratic Institute conducted a few weeks ago, in which there was a clear indication from those surveyed interviewed that they would expect political parties participating in this kind of debate and that they would question those who don't take part.
How articulate were the presidential aspirants who did take part on key issues like corruption and improving the agriculture and education sectors?
In general, they were quite articulate and they were clear also commitments that were being undertaken. For instance, I remember hearing the candidate of the United Democratic Front, you know, making himself ready to declare his assets well before the elections and calling upon the other candidates to do likewise. Probably because of lack of time, there wasn't enough time dedicated to specific details in terms of how the different kind of policy positions are going to be translated into action.
It's barely a month before the elections. Are the winds of change of leadership blowing in Malawi?
The forthcoming election is obviously going to be very, very competitive. It's a tight race, particularly among the top four, DPP, UDF, MCP, and PP. At this point, it's too close to call, and I think it can go either way. One thing that is very clear is that whoever is going to win is going to win with a very narrow margin.
And what should be the urgent issue to address for the next president of Malawi?
Obviously, bring back confidence, public confidence in the economy. Public finance management is going to be very, very key. So restoring confidence in the economy and restoring confidence also of the development partners, I think that's also going to be very, very key. And most importantly, I think, being elections that are being held as the country celebrates 50 years of independence, there is also quite an expectation that the incoming government must clearly define how Malawi is going to be different 50 years to come.
I was speaking to Augustine Magolwondo from the Netherlands Institute for Multi-Party Democracy, based in Lilongwe, Malawi.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
Let's now head to South Sudan, where ethnic massacres have spiraled out of control and politicians seem to be losing their grip on rampaging militias as a four-month-old power struggle between the government and the rebels continues. The past week has been described by a senior UN official as the most bleak in South Sudan's short history, with pro-government gunmen storming a UN base in an attempt to kill thousands of terrified civilians, and the rebels accused of conducting massacres in churches, mosques, and hospitals. Before we came on air, I spoke to DW's head of English for Africa Department, Daniel Pels, and I started by asking him how serious the situation was in South Sudan.
It really seems to escalate quite seriously, because what we saw in Bentiu for the first time is that not only rebels and government troops clashed, but that apparently also hate messages were broadcast on a local FM radio station telling people to go out and kill members of another ethnic group. So that means this conflict is definitely taking on an ethnic dimension. Both parties have for quite some time used ethnic stereotypes and ethnic divisions to gain more supporters and to incite their supporters. But apparently and increasingly now, people are taking matters into their own hands. What we have to keep in mind is those rebels are not a unified group with a central command. They are rather a loose network of different militias, different rebel forces. And some primarily fight because they want to drive members of other ethnic groups out. And if this ethnic tension gets serious, then this conflict could really take many more lives.
Now, is the UN able to fulfill its mandate of protecting civilians? Because the Ugandan army has released a statement saying it could have done more to protect the civilians from being killed.
I don't think that the UN can fulfill its mandate. When I was in South Sudan, I talked to a senior officer of the UN mission who told me privately that the mission was lacking a lot of equipment. For instance, at that time, I mean, I don't know if that is still the case, it was lacking enough helicopters for serious air surveillance. You know, we have to remember Sudan, South Sudan is a vast area. You have huge areas that have no roads, that are not accessible by car. You can only see what is going on if troops are moving, for instance, through air surveillance. So you might have troops on the ground, but if you don't have sufficient air surveillance, you don't know how to move them and where to put them. So one issue is a shortage of material. The other thing, the combat troops of the UN mission are largely coming from poorer, underdeveloped countries. They are poorly trained and they're often also very, very poorly equipped. There are a lot of nations, Germany is one of them, always boasting that they have sent soldiers to South Sudan. In fact, they have sent officers who are sitting in offices who are doing planning and coordination work. But the combat troops on the ground are often not trained enough to fulfill this really difficult mandate.
Peace talks have been postponed to the end of April. Are they going to achieve anything?
I doubt that very much. It seems, and that for me is the lesson that we learned from Bentiu, that both sides are going to battle it out and they're determined to battle it out. What we have to keep in mind is all the major players in this conflict are actually former guerrilla fighters. They don't have any experience working in a democratic and open system of government. They're not used to solving conflicts peacefully. The only way they have solved conflicts over the last 20 or 30 years is actually on the battlefield. So I think this is a huge issue here, and I can only hope that the international community will do more to put pressure on both sides to find a peaceful solution, because otherwise the death toll is going to get higher and higher.
I was speaking to Daniel Pels, DW's Head of English for Africa Department.
Behind the headlines.
Now, 30 years ago, the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, that causes AIDS was discovered. Since then, it has claimed millions of lives, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. But while knowing one's status is a commendable step, for one man in Zimbabwe, it turned out to be his worst nightmare after he tested HIV positive and disclosed his status. Columbus Mavunga brings us the story of Maxwell Kachapao, a former clergyman with the Anglican Church who was excommunicated for testing positive.
Former clergyman Maxwell Kachapao came up with the idea of the abandoned Grace Ministries in 2005 after his church banned him from working as a priest after he disclosed his HIV-positive status. He was, in fact, the first religious figure in Zimbabwe to come out into the open. Since then, he has discovered that he is not alone. Other people in the same situation in other churches have joined him, and together they've launched the Abandoned Grace Ministries, where HIV-infected people can worship together and share their problems and experiences. Maxwell Kachapao told me more about the motivation.
Abundant Grace Ministries is a ministry that came out of a very big heart. People living in isolation as religious leaders, knowing fully how we also at one time we were stigmatized, just trying to show our community that despite the HIV, we can still live meaningful, productive lives, proud of ourselves, and trying to show people around that HIV is a virus, it's not a moral issue.
The 41-year-old Kapachao has teamed up with other HIV-positive church leaders as well as ordinary Christians who carry the virus and feel discriminated against by their churches. He says, given the high level of infection in Africa, it is high time church leaders on the continent change their attitude towards HIV-positive Christians.
If we say God is love, but this love when we come to HIV is not visible, I think it's high time that our church leaders in Africa have to revisit their theology. We need to be realistic. It doesn't mean that when I say I'm HIV positive today, it doesn't mean I'm a bad person. They have to accept it. We have children, we have been born HIV positive. What message do we have? Why should we crucify these children? Why should we condemn them? They never decided to be born from parents who are like this.
The father of four says his strong feelings about HIV stem partly from his family. Kapachao has lost three siblings to HIV-related illnesses, including one who committed suicide after he tested positive. The pastor is currently undergoing antiretroviral treatment together with one of the remaining two siblings. Francis Kapachao is the oldest son of the former clergyman. He told me that he has vivid memories of how his friends and schoolmates treated him after his father declared that he was HIV positive about 7 years ago. Francis said fellow students started shunning him when playing or even in class.
I just spoke that it is my dad. I was never ashamed of anything. I just spoke, it was my dad. But, you know, at school, it wasn't an easy thing for
me. And today, what is it like?
Today, I'm very proud of what is happening to him and to my family as well. It's a very proud thing, even in Africa. When I look at him, when I look at the support that my family gave him, I'm very proud of it.
What message would you send, given a chance, what message would you send to African leaders, political leaders, or church leaders about HIV disclosure and etc.?
What I can only say is we have to let us unite together and fight HIV/AIDS, not to fight each other. HIV is a virus, not a moral disease.
On the African continent, as in other parts of the world, discrimination of HIV-infected people is still widespread. In Zimbabwe, the government has tried to implement policies to ensure that HIV-related issues are openly discussed to ease such discrimination. But so far, this has not yielded many results.
Columbus Mavunga in Harare. And now it's time for our ongoing special series on South Africa. And we hear from the young generation born after the end of apartheid. They are called the Born Free Generation and are about to embark on adult life in the new South Africa. These Born Frees will also participate in the 2014 national elections as the first generation in post-apartheid South Africa. This report by Kirsten Velte has been adapted for Africa Link by Crispin Mwakideu.
Hello, my name is Mudau Mufuniwa Amanda, and I was born on the 25th of December, 1994.
Alexandra Nash, my birthday is on the 25th of August, 1994.
My name is Jeffrey Mlaudzi, I was born in 1992.
My name is Tiffany Siam, I was born on the 3rd of September, 1993.
My name is Megan Thomas, and I was born in October, 1994.
The voices of some of South Africa's Born Frees, so-called because all of them were born after Nelson Mandela came out of prison in 1990. In theory, they are equal citizens with the same opportunities, but in practice, they continue to live very different lives. Tiffany Siem, a young black woman, is one of the Born Frees.
Fine, we're born free and we have free of will, and you can make your own choices and create your own path in life. But then we're still catching up economically, we're still catching up with learning to integrate with other people. People are still oppressed, whether it's the color of your skin or the village you're from or the language you speak. Obviously, it's less than before, and it's not based on rules of the country, but it's still individuals and how they're raised that affects the way they think and the way they walk through life, I guess.
Tiffany is sitting in the sun on the campus of the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, where she studies environmental management and geology. Almost 1 million students in South Africa from different races, religions and social backgrounds mingle every day. Though Tiffany might represent the best example of how the old racial prejudices have slowly faded, she says differences still exist.
It's really unnecessary. I mean, it's stupid because if a black girl starts dating a white guy, she feels like she's made it in life kind of thing. And I'm like, why? You just have more melanin in your skin than he does kind of thing. So why is it such a big deal? You're in the same school, speak the same languages, learn the same thing. So why does it need to be like, oh, because I'm most associated with this group of people, I am better?
Tiffany comes from a predominantly white suburb of Johannesburg. Her mother, a former house help, now manager, told Tiffany to take education seriously and to make something out of her life. Tiffany's upbringing certainly differs from that of Alex Nash and Megan Thomas, sitting in a cafe at a shopping centre located in the affluent Sandton Financial District. As the two girlfriends sip on their iced coffee, the conversation is mostly focused about private schools, large gardens, holiday homes, and vacation in Europe. They grew up more or less just like their white parents. The only difference, Alex says, is that they didn't experience apartheid.
Our high school was pretty mixed. We had girls who were like did live in Soweto and they were on bursaries there. We know for a fact that it was quite hard for them. They would obviously, like, we're used to having cars. They'd have to take the bus home. In the beginning, they didn't really have cell phones. I think it must have been hard, like, especially from their perspective, to all of a sudden be exposed to a society where there is this money. I felt a bit uncomfortable sometimes. Most of my friends are quite privileged, but if you did speak to them, it is you have to be cautious as to what you say because you can feel quite uncomfortable.
Despite the fact that democracy has brought unprecedented opportunities for most young South Africans, nearly two-thirds of the born-free generation have no job or a good education. For many like Tiffany, it is Nelson Mandela's vision of a fair, transparent and tolerant South African society that gives them hope for the future, even if, as she points out, no political party seems exactly right for the future at the moment.
We can't continue to blame the people who govern us. We need to take a stand for our own lives. I mean, people who fought for our freedom. If they had just sat down and said, oh, the government is useless and the government is oppressing us, we wouldn't have this freedom. So then the same way, our youth also needs to take a stand for their own lives and a stand for their own freedom.
Crispin Mwakideo presented that report by Kirsten Velte.
Opinion.
For our opinion slot this week, let's go back to our top story in Malawi, where for the first time a televised debate was held to give the presidential candidates a chance to articulate their plans for the country. But the main contenders, including the incumbent President Joyce Banda, were not present, a move that angered Malawians.
This shows the lack of seriousness on the part of the incumbent president and anyone who failed to make it.
The head of state failing to turn up for the first ever debate, not for just this election, but in the history of politics in Malawi. It shows lack of commitment to coming out clear on what she intended to do.
We now ask, could snubbing such a crucial debate hurt the chances of President Joyce Banda and Peter Mutharika in the May election? Tell us what you think by sending an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, a letter to Africa Link, DW53110, Bonn, Germany, or an SMS to +4916095759510, and we will read some of your comments right here on the program. And before we remind you the headlines, reports are coming in that a car has exploded after driving into a police station in Nairobi. The Inspector General of Police said two police officers were among those killed in the explosion. We will follow up on this story as it comes or as it continues to develop. And now a reminder of the stories that we've covered. Malawi has held the first ever presidential debate ahead of elections next month, with the main contenders, including President Joyce Banda, upset. We've heard from a Zimbabwean clergyman who was banned from his church because he disclosed he was HIV positive. We've also been hearing from young South Africans for whom apartheid is just a part of history. And there we come to the end of the program. Africa Link returns tomorrow at the same time with me, Isaac Mugabe, in Bonn.